As a non-commercial educational radio station, KCC supports the free expression of ideas. Please be aware that the opinions expressed are those of the speakers or artists only and do not necessarily reflect the views of the UC Regents, KCC, staff, management, or underwriters. We welcome your feedback on our programming. Please direct your comments to the Program Review Committee at 831-459-4726 or by email at prc@kcsc.org. Awesome. So, hello everyone. Thank you for attending KCC's first News and Talk event. Woohoo! On Monday, January 20th, the presidential inauguration took place in front of politicians, CEOs, priests, former presidents, constituents, and more. To allow the former and re-elected President Donald Trump to speak directly to the constituents regarding the goals set for the upcoming four-year term. As the country is coming to what Trump declared as the golden age for America, there are questions, comments, support, and indifference from constituents about how it will affect the individual and our nation. Today, KZSC's goal is to facilitate an open-ended discussion for those interested in contributing to these critical conversations. The attention for this space will be to question the world we live in, as it is our duty as agents of change to comprehend political layers. As the inauguration took place on Martin Luther King Day, I've decided to leave a little quote with this introduction, so here it is. We must come to see that the end we seek is a society at peace with itself, a society that can live with its conscience. So just keep that in mind. That being said, KCC welcomes all ideas, so nonetheless, there will be no cruelty towards another's beliefs, as this is an open-ended conversation and not a debate. In Joe Biden's final address to the nation, Biden broadcasted a warning to the American people with concerns about the rise of an oligarchy within the United States. How will these larger entities affect the working class? Have they already? What actions can the individual take to condense the concentration of power and wealth? Does anybody want to share first? I can pass the mic around. Any takers? Yeah, awesome. Thank you so much.
Hi, everyone. My name is Riley. I think that a big part of it is that it's very difficult for the individual to do anything to combat things on a federal level, which is why I think it's important that we strengthen our community activism. Decrease the idea that we all must be individualist, all, you know, self, keep only to ourselves, and strengthen our bonds as communities and as laborers. We all work together as the labor in this country, and people deserve to be treated with respect that the oligarchy does not give, and thus we point as I'm saying that we do have more control that we may realize in this situation as small members of a community, even if it may not directly influence the federal government.
Yeah, that's a really good point. Especially now, I feel like there's more of a divide within our nation, just in general, as people, not as ideologies. So it's like, what are the steps that we can take to be united as, you know, it's us versus them, not necessarily like you're Republican, you're Democrat, you know, more of a unified entity.
I think just to that point, and I feel like I talk about this a lot with my friends, I think that at this point, like the Democrat-Republican kind of split to me doesn't really feel legit. I think that they're right, there's a large portion of the country that is not super rich, and then there's a really tiny portion of the country that basically controls the government, and we talk about what is an oligarchy. We looked it up, and it's when a country is controlled by a very small group of people. So, and you could talk all about that and what that means, but I do kind of think that. But I guess, like, to what you were saying about ideology and, like, how to unify, I think that there's been a lot of real critiques of the Democratic Party and its failings that are then used to recruit people to, like I would say, the extreme right, which I think is also largely not actually in service of most people. And so I think that it's actually really useful, like, you know, the culture wars, as they're called, are very useful to the elite, but at the same time are very dangerous for real people when you're talking about, you know, trans violence, and you're talking about deportation and all these other things, right, that are like so-called identity politics. I think that they're very real, but they're also very useful to, you know, divide the working class and all that. I just wanted to say that.
So, yeah, monopolies, oligopolies, I have a bit of a background in economics, so I can probably talk about this like a reasonable amount. The most people are able to detail, but increase the prices for consumers because less competition means they don't have to compete for the same people. And that means an ever-increasing cost of living crisis, more inflation. It's a large part of why wages have stagnated over the years, despite productivity rising drastically since 2008, for example. Market concentration has only gone up over time, and the individual consumer isn't really in a position to do anything about this, because that's, you know, the way that monopolies and oligopolies were broken up in the early 20th century was with forced government action to make sure that their uncompetitive practices were stopped. Standard Oil didn't stop because people started buying gas from a different company, because it just wasn't realistically possible. They had a lot of ways of ensuring that. You did that because you broke up companies into 30 different ones, and, you know, hope that they would compete just by comprising largely the same people. And just generally, you need to find ways to get the government to directly intervene against these companies in a way that is simply not possible if they're in a basically VIP lounge at the inauguration as one of the core parts of the new administration, either directly or indirectly.
Yeah, it's interesting how that part plays into our system and government as a whole. You know, it's like this fourth entity is now trying to force its way into the checks and balances that we've set since 1776. It's a really good point there.
Something that is really, I guess, not confusing about the political state, but just more disturbing, is that what we see is that, like brought up, mentioned earlier, the idea of like these like culture wars and like things to divide the like working class, as opposed to the real divide being, instead of Democratic, Republican, it's just lower class and upper class. And even upper class, it's like not even upper class, it's top 0.00 whatever, five guys standing behind Trump during his inauguration that just kind of really say out loud, hey, we run this thing. And it's so disturbing to see people fight over these other issues that are so clearly just kind of boogeymen in a sense. It's this idea of like, hey, get mad about this instead of getting mad about this. And I don't understand how it's so prevalent, especially like you see, like this election cycle, you had the Teamsters endorse Trump, and this kind of shift where the Democrats kind of lost ground with the working class and unions, and they all went towards Trump's side. And then in the end, after he's actually elected, it's Elon running the Department of Government Efficiency, and just this very upfront, billionaire-friendly, his tax plan, everything about his platform and what he says and does actionably is billionaire friendly. And yet somehow it's still this, like, we are so distracted by everything else that we have this divide to the point of like unions endorsing the billionaire's candidate. And I mean, I don't have a solution, obviously. I don't think there is anything necessarily that the individual does. I think we do need to stop talking about it like it's an individual thing, because that is also a part of the capitalist system to begin with. But it is disturbing, and it's odd to say as well, because I feel like in a lot of political discussion, even when you talk to people who traditionally would disagree with you or are supposed to disagree with you based on their own like political label, a lot of people really do kind of agree on economics. They just don't like the labels that tend to get attached to them, and like the stigmatized terms that are fear-mongered a lot, but they practically are saying a lot of the same things. So, I mean, I think that's a hopeful thing in the end, because it means we are on the same page in some ways.
In our current era of the rise of populism and polarization, how do we reconcile the tension between majority rule and minority rights? How could this prevent democratic backsliding, or is there another way to stop democratic erosion?
Personally, I think people are influenced these days with their opinion and with social media and with what they see and other views, their friends' views. People aren't actually open to conversation, and this might be a unique crowd of people who are more open to having a conversation here, but with how people view things today, I think it has become more and more polarizing. And so it's a question about how do we engage people to actually be open to hearing the other side of the conversation, or hearing both sides, or getting to a middle ground that is possible.
Thank you, Kara.
Okay. So I want to address a second or a different part of the question, a different aspect is this concept of like majority, tyranny of the majority, which is just, in my eyes, is just this boogeyman that's been around since like 1859. And the whole concept of, oh, the people are going to have too much say and they don't know what they're talking about is something that was like foundational. The founding fathers, when they made the country, we don't live in a democracy, we live in a republic. And it's something that over time just becomes more and more clear as politics develops to this point where the fact is, before the last election, Republicans hadn't won a popular vote since 2004, right? The fact is that we have a system in which unpopular minority, less than majority, can win all the time. That's absolutely not something that is at risk. Most Americans support climate change, or not support climate change, excuse me, I hope not. Most Americans believe in, which is a heavy quotation marks because this isn't something that is a belief, it's science, but believe in climate change. And yet on Trump's day one in office, he rolled back the Paris Agreement, he took away charters for offshore windmills, he did all this stuff and won the popular vote. So the question is really not the tyranny of the majority, because it really seems to be the minority that gets everything they want in this country, and that minority has consistently been billionaires for the past 20 years, and it's really disturbing to see. And this concept that we need to even further lessen what the majority of Americans want in such a time when it feels like our leaders are smashing their head into a brick wall with so many issues, such as climate change. Like, we know this is going to lead us down a path of destruction for all of us that can't afford rocket ships to Mars, and yet it keeps happening. We live in an era of politics such as that, where the obvious answer feels like it's right there, and yet it consistently doesn't happen. We need more tyranny, heavy quotation marks, of the majority than ever right now, I feel.
That's a good point there.
I have a sub-question to what you were talking about. Or my question is, what should we do, you know, in a situation like that? Do we kind of go along with what has been happening? I mean, what can we do as the agents of change, like going to be, you know, the newer generation that has a say, because we do have a say, just as individuals, as a community, to kind of, you know, alter that?
I think one big thing for me, because I've been doing political organizing for a long time, started around climate change. And honestly, things like this are really important and honestly really don't happen enough. People just physically coming together in their area and like talking about political issues, like you have to start there. And I think that, like, you know, yeah, all the stuff that happens online, it's so much easier for it to become a fight and an argument. And yeah, I think on a really deep level, like, I think the place we need to start is, yeah, we need to plug back into what's actually going on. Like, we need to know, like, who our council member is. And I think that's a big one. And you can start to deprogram all the kind of fear around what you're supposed to think and what the popular opinion is, whatever. I'll let other people speak on this or whatever. But, yeah.
Democratic backsliding is occurring largely not because of the majority of people actively want your vote to not count or for things happen. It's just because right-wing groups especially see that they're increasingly a minority viewpoint that expands due to misinformation and whatever have you. Basically, the idea that the tyranny of the majority conflicts with minority rights, except in a very, very few circumstances, it's almost always false. The greatest threat to democracy in virtually every country around the world since the dawn of time is basically elite groups that see short-term gains to their personal wealth or personal power as more important than the ability of people to participate in their own government. In the long run, it's not even good for them. Democracies have, I mean, they're better in terms of human development, they're better in terms of rule of law, and all these are things that the rich themselves rely on, but they think that they can get a bigger piece of the pie, even as the pie grows smaller, and that is the reason democracies backslide. And they fund groups, and they fund, like, pundits. As an example of this sort of effect, just recently, a bunch of right-wing influencers were caught by federal investigators for receiving money from Russia and other things. to promote narratives against Ukraine. Similar things occur all the time with companies like PragerU, which promote direct literal right-wing propaganda as university lectures, pretty much. These sort of disinformation things are a result of elite desires, not an organic desire from people.
Okay. I wanted to make a comment on something that you had mentioned earlier about the influence of social media in general. Could you say that one more time, just about that?
Yeah. I think there's certain views people have. And there's algorithms made into social media where it's like you're watching your own opinion and your own input being played over and over and over again, and you're getting what you're looking for, which is totally fine, but it's more dividing. You're not open to having a conversation usually. It's more of your opinion that you are seeing on social media.
Sorry,
it's almost like it's reinforcing your belief and kind of drilling that, so you're programmed to believe that that is your belief, and in my mind, that's kind of how I observe it.
Well, I find it interesting because I find it interesting how people decide, what they care about, you know what I mean? It's and this can be kind of tied to, the political climate of, our campus, UC Santa Cruz, right? So, I think in the past spring quarter, we saw just how powerful we can be as a campus. The encampment was one of the most, I don't think I've ever seen students unite like that here. And I find it really interesting how that was something that people really wanted to unite over and come together, and people really went out of their way to come together for, and yet so many issues that are so prevalent, in Santa Cruz, have had, little to no, involvement by the campus community. A bus driver literally died, on campus, and, imagine what could happen if, people came together for things happening in our local community, which is, something we were talking about in the prior question, so, yeah.
I'm not saying this on the microphone, so I'm first year, and I wasn't there last spring quarter, and I'm just curious about, I've heard a lot of stuff, but I haven't really heard very concentrated, I don't know if this is the place to ask what happens, maybe after.
No, you can ask.
Say on that, but for this discussion right now.
Yeah, you can go for it if you want to. Yeah, a little small debrief, of course.
Small debrief.
Okay.
Yeah, a small debrief of campus.
Well, do you have any, or you can go,
Or I don't know who here, if you want to, who came to the encampment at some point last year, right? I got arrested. Big flex. thank you. But I'll just say a quick thing, I guess. I think in a lot of ways it was amazing, because everyone was in the same place at the same time. I think that was what was so great about it, but it was also extremely stressful. I think we're not used to, imagine this. But it's just all day. I think people aren't used to that, and it was very stressful. Obviously we didn't get what we wanted. We didn't get the school to divest their money. But we had a food kitchen running basically all the time.
There's hundreds of people.
Hundreds and hundreds of people sleeping there every single night. It was at the quarry, and then we moved to the base of campus. I can tell you more about it.
Well, if you have I just think just the idea that we can stop normal function of the university, people could not enter through the base of campus, the entirety of the Santa Cruz police force plus I think from San Jose, there was so much attention that was able to be brought to the situation because of students coming together. And so just I think that it's just really, it was a really revealing, I hope that people were able to understand just how powerful they were, I think.
that's made me think of, again, more polarizing things, in that while there is a large part of the student body that is very political and knows that, you know, working together can bring noticeable effect, there's also the problem of that I've noticed still a lot of political apathy in some of my peers. You know, they don't care what happens in politics. They don't care who they buy from, what the companies they buy from do. And that concerns me as well. And I've noticed even in class, you bring up something political, and there's always a distinct half of the class that, like, you can see, like, rolling their eyes a little bit, at least in my experience.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And that kind of segues to my next question. How important do you find, or do you want to go for it? Do you want to speak?
Well, I just want to say, like, really quick, yeah. I feel like there's, I think that the political climate has kind of come to a point where it's, like, inaccessible, like, especially for our generation. Like, mm-hmm. I think that there's, like, so much polarization that people are, like, it's daunting to even try to explore politics on, like, a very surface level mm-hmm. because of how extreme the climate has gotten. Like, cancel culture is, like, a great, you know, you can't be curious anymore. You can't have, like, ask a question without fear, I feel like.
It almost starts this its own erosion of itself because of the influence of social media as well. You kind of are being fed these beliefs, and then you're so stuck to them that when someone does ask you a question, you get worked up about it. You're so invested in these beliefs that you just want to prove why the other person's wrong. And I think that's why things don't necessarily work, because we can't have an open discussion like this and, you know, let me hear what you think, you can hear what I think, and maybe we can come to a middle ground, and that's okay. And I don't need to necessarily believe everything you do, just like you don't have to me. And I think that we're just in this daze right now, and there's so many distractions everywhere that we're missing the bigger picture. We're missing that last piece of the puzzle. It's just, it's interesting because I want to try, I mean, I put on this event so that we can come to terms of, like, what can we do? Because right now, I don't know what to do. As an individual, I'm lost because, you know, part of me wants to go out on the streets and start a riot and make these oligarchy, you know, individuals and corporations and the government understand what, you know, we're frustrated about. But the only way I can do some sort of activism. So, I mean, I don't have an answer, but that's kind of where I'm at.
Yes, just to, like, not a solution, but I think a big part of combating polarization, I guess, would be a lot of its exposure. Like, I come from a small town, and, like, yes, we are a blue county, but I don't know, I feel like there's certain things that you just, like, don't talk about with certain people kind of thing. And everybody keeps to themselves, and I don't know, how to explain this? Okay, community, you know, we all have different communities, and I feel like even, like, you know, in a small town setting, like, there's a community, and I feel like when, like, politics arise, things become polarized, like, it's hard, like, to be in a community to try to reach out and have that conversation. I feel like communities are very close and tight-knit, and when there's this kind of outsider, this outside idea, like, it feels threatening. So, like, willingness is a huge part of it, is, like, being willing to be wrong and to, like, be okay with unlearning and learning, you know? I feel like that's a big part of it, is just getting out of that comfortable space and being uncomfortable.
Yeah, I would say that in our modern political environment, in general, I think the biggest change that social media has brought to society is that it's made online interaction significantly easier and seemingly less risky than in-person social interaction. Right. And that makes it way easier to just go online to get the social fix that our minds and bodies need as social animals, rather than trying to go out and try to potentially make an awkward conversation or meet someone you super disagree with or not find is, like, problematic in some other way. And it's important to remember, most people are at least trying to be good human beings. And most people are trying to interact with others in a good way. As hard as it is to believe, that is often true, even for people who are not of the same side as you. When you're on social media, it presents you the most divisive, the most negative version of events, because that's what gets your attention. And that's not just social media, it's news media, that's every form of media in America. There are statistics that show it's even worse here than other countries. And, you know, but, at, you know, at the same time, I have someone in this room that I've had, like, a pseudo spat or debate, whatever you call it with, but they're generally not a bad person. We fist bumped just earlier this morning. And yeah, and like it's like people are not generally trying to be evil on average. you know, make connections, make friendships, help people understand point of view, and maybe just down the line, either you can get something valuable from them, or they can get something valuable for you to think about. And that is connection. That's how you organize. That is how you breach divides. And we need to do more of that, or else we're just going to be stuck in this situation the next 50 or years or so.
I also just want to bring up another effect that has happened because of the viralization of online discourse and because of political conversation kind of being moved online, is that two things: is that politics and political beliefs, they become part of somebody's community and also their identity, to this point where it's like community, you know, we kind of mentioned this with the small town thing, but it's also just on a broader sense. It's like, if you're going to make friends online with people who have your same opinion, that kind of, it breeds itself. Like, we have echo chambers for sure because of our algorithms, but we also have echo chambers because we choose to go to places where we're going to hear our beliefs parroted back to us to a certain degree. And also, we live in a very, very hyper-individualist society as product of capitalism, but also that breeds this idea that you have to have this kind of sense of self, and your sense of self has to be this like fixed brand that you're going to present on your Instagram. And right, we're a very performative generation, and politics being performative has become part of our culture in such a way that people are not willing to have conversations like this. People are not willing to enter into a debate with even the slightest inkling that maybe I'm going to change my mind here, because people enter into debates with, instead of saying, I'm going to have this talk and figure out where this person's coming from, where I'm coming from, where we can meet in the middle, where we can reconcile. None of that. It's, I'm going to enter into this conversation and be very performative about my identity and show this person what I believe. And we all do this hoping that maybe the next person will have the, you know, neuroplasticity that we aren't exemplifying ourselves. But I think that's a product of an online generation. When we're talking about what do we do, like what do we do, the answer is so genuinely and so honestly, just get off your phone. Just talk, go to events like this, meet people, have actual conversations in real spaces. Because, I mean, this has already been mentioned by everyone, but there's just a very, very different set of etiquette in person as compared to online. I mean, like, online, people do not know how to act because there's never a risk of seeing someone face-to-face. But in person, people generally realize that they can't be complete total weirdos or hostile and get away with it as effectively as they can by just, you know, pressing the block button. So, yeah, we should get off our phones.
I totally agree with all of that. We should get off our phones. But I know that I have family members that are freak weirdos when you talk to them in person. And it's hard to have conversations with these people and, like, really get through to them. I learned this term in one of my classes this morning, and it's agnostic solidarity. And it's the idea of, like, oh, you could be fighting with people over certain issues or the way you do things, the way you live, whatever, but you come together in solidarity over the common enemy. And I think it's very clear that we all have the common enemy of these higher powers with all this money and power and control. But yeah, it's really hard to get through to people who have differing beliefs and just, you know, can be difficult people sometimes.
Yeah, I think that this is something I've been, like, I mean, my family is, like, super just, like, extreme in, like, many different ways. And so I think I've been in a lot of environments, like, growing up where, like, I have been kind of faced with, like, these people that have, like, these freak weirdo, like, in my opinion, kind of beliefs on things. I don't know, what I've learned is that if people are able to approach those kinds of people with more of, like, I mean, this is just, like, going back to my other point where it's, like, it's such a privilege to, like, hear another perspective. Like, I feel like hearing the freak weirdo's perspective is, like, I really want to know what you have to say, and I want to, like, really question why you believe that. And, like, I feel like I've done that many times, and I question them, and they often have questions for me, too. And so, like, once you open up kind of this environment where it's just, like, general curiosity and, like, less, like, debate style or, like, I want to prove you wrong or, like, I want to tell you how I feel, like, this is why that I it's right, you know? And I think if people were to, and this is just like, again, like individual action, like I think it's really hard to like tell or like convince like a huge group of people that this is like a really great way to approach situations like this, because a lot of people are really emotionally tied to a lot of their like political beliefs or just like beliefs in general. But yeah, if like we were able to foster a culture of just like curiosity and understanding, and I think if everyone were to like let their guards down a little bit, we would be able to actually probably agree with a lot of what the Freak Weirder has to say. So.
And my question is how important do you find participation in local government? Are there ways to offset federal changes through active community participation? Can community be used as a tool to allow for greater changes to combat larger federal dissatisfaction? Yeah, we can start now. We don't have to do small groups.
Well, I think it's important to also acknowledge the points in between, those being of, you know, you mentioned city government, but also like state ballot measures too. Like there were some very, there is a reason that, you know, people consider California to be a sanctuary state in comparison to other states. And it's because we pass, you know, sometimes more progressive ballot measures than other states. Now, this most recent election, a lot of the ones I personally would have liked to have gotten passed did not. But that's beside the point. This isn't about me. I'm just saying that it's important for us to also to vote on all levels of government, and in addition to our non-voting activism.
It's interesting though, because I feel like a lot of individuals aren't participating in those elections as well.
And progress can be slow, but it can be impactful. It's like, I don't know. I think this is a Lenin quote that people quote to me all the time. It's that, that, you know, there's years where nothing happens, and there's weeks where years happen. I see you mouthing what I'm saying because it gets said so much in leftist spaces. It's a great quote.
Vladimir Lenin.
Can you repeat the quote one more time?
It's something like, can I try it again?
Yes.
I think the way I tweeted this once. I said, this was in reference to me really wanting to get laid in high school, and I said it's going to happen because there are decades when nothing happens, and there are weeks where decades happen. Censored for the radio show. But I definitely agree, and I wanted to say I feel like part of it is that you can't really choose when everyone decides to start giving a right? Like, after October 7th happens, you know, and this is something that had been going on in that area for a very, very long time, but after that happened, people started caring a lot, and it became a movement. And then I guess most recently, honestly, I think the only other thing I could think of that people was in the air was Luigi Mangione when he killed the CEO of UnitedHealthcare. But I don't really know where I was going with this, but yeah, I think that the energy is always in the air, and I think the more that we, as you say, are together, are focusing on local issues, are talking, are doing things, I don't know. I don't have the solution, but yeah.
Why do people care about that?
I want to throw in this little anecdote, but I was a poll worker for this election, and also a poll worker for the midterm in 2022, and the difference in the voting center, just the energy, is so striking because it's so clear during the midterm that people care more, which is odd. You'd expect it to be the other way around. You'd expect it to be, oh, well, everyone cares about the presidential election, not the midterms. But the thing is that the people who show up to vote in the midterm elections, they know what they're doing, and what they're doing is organizing and voting and participating on a local level, and that has effect. They know that, and people who go to the presidential election don't really feel that. I feel like there's a very, very general apathy, political apathy that we've been talking about a little bit, but something that really factors into it is that people don't believe fundamentally that their vote does anything, right? There's a very common sentiment that if you're engaging by going and voting, that it doesn't matter. And I feel like that's one of the biggest things that weighs our generation down, because we're at a very, very delicate moment in history, probably, when we're going to look back in 50 years, if we're there to look back in 50 years. People are going to see right now, you know, the 2020s, and it's going to be like, that was crazy. And there's so much going on that the individual person feels like, why even bother, right? And I think that's the biggest thing that we need to do, is we need to get people excited by getting people to understand that when you do things, things happen. As crazy as it sounds, as absolutely mind-boggling an idea, the thing is that, you know what, I'll throw my own quote. I don't know who, but no raindrop feels responsible for the flood. And typically, that's used as like a, oh, well, I'm going to do this bad action anyway because it doesn't really affect the fact that other people are doing it. But I think you can also look at it in this idea that if you do something good, maybe it doesn't feel like it matters. But if we all do something good and go out and vote on a local level, on a district level, at a midterm level, when it's not in the news cycle, when there's no celebrities posting about it on social media, when we do it still, it's still good. And when we all do it, it really is going to do something. And I think that's one of the ways we're going to overcome this political apathy we've got right now. And that's one of the ways that we're going to improve the state of things.
Yeah, adding on to that point, especially vote in the primaries. Vote in the primaries, vote in the primaries, vote in the primaries. Everywhere in America, if there is especially in areas where one party dominates, vote in the primaries. They determine which candidates are on the ballot. So if you think the Democratic Party is too corporate or Republican Party too vote in the primaries and get them to pick someone better. And if you're just voting at the general election, you are effectively voting when the decision has kind of mostly been made, to be frank, about who's going to be allowed to run. I mean, that's how Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez managed to win over the top three Democrat in the House and basically shove him out of politics forever. People need to participate in a local level and need to vote. But even more importantly than that, arguably, they need to participate and vote where people aren't voting. Primaries turnout is absolutely abysmal. Like local party conventions, even where they make endorsements and stuff. I was a part of a campaign in Minnesota for a mayoral candidate, and there was like an endorsement process with local Democratic Party. Like 500 people tops came in a town of like, not even 500, it was like 1 or 200 in a town of 20,000 people. No one goes to those things, but it can potentially outweigh the election. Not in that case, unfortunately. But yeah, vote in the primaries.
Yeah. Totally. I just want to add to that because I feel like, and I, for myself personally, definitely, like, I am often skeptical of the electoral process and the electoral government in general. Like, when I was younger, like, we were lobbying the state government it was a climate change related thing. And we were talking to these state assemblymen and they were all Democrats and they were all awful, or like most of them, you know, like they couldn't do anything. Like it was really defeating for me. And I know after that, I was like, this, like, you know, we need the revolutions, you know, we're done with this. Like, right. I will say my grandparents, who were militant communists and were like, you know, trying to burn down the empire, and they still, you know, want that in spirit. Now when I talk to them, they're always just like, you gotta vote, tell the young people to vote, which is crazy. Like, so I guess all this to say, I do think that there are very real limits that need to be acknowledged in terms of the democratic process and electoral politics. But I do also really agree that people are extremely unengaged, especially on like local levels, and that there should be more. I think it would be very helpful. So I want to say that.
I just want to make a comment on like the general engagement idea. Like I think that people that really understand what it takes in order to, like, I guess a good question is like, what can actually be done, or like, what can we do to create this culture where people understand that it's like important to be engaged and like to be involved. And I also want to just comment on like how do we as people that like understand or like are trying our best to understand what's going on not become like bogged down by how much work it's actually going to take to like foster a culture within our generation that isn't apathetic to politics. Yeah. And you know,
almost as if like, how do we get people to realize how much of an impact they can actually make
to like vote
in to the, vote yeah
in the primaries and yeah. All that.
I think that's an effect to like people widely underestimate their power in these smaller, like, primary elections. Like, and I think the more that they see that in these smaller elections their voices matter, that can, like, change the shift, like, in bigger elections later. later. Because if we understand that if we vote in, like, representatives in the state or, like, you know, the assemblies based on what we want in the primaries, that can shift the way we, like, interact nationally. I just think that this status quo and the incumbent, like, you know, success rate is so high because those primaries, like, turnout is so low that we just don't see the effect of our vote. And I think that is a problem. For example, there's a, Santa Cruz actually is going to hold a special election, I think, either this next year, I think, on housing. And it's about, it's a housing measure. And it's just a Santa Cruz, like, ballot measure. Because Santa Cruz locals and, like, people who live here generally do support building housing. But because, like, it kind of gets trampled over in the, like, bigger elections, they, like, it consistently has failed because it gets trampled over and people don't know what they're voting for.
Yeah.
So they're making a special election that is just Santa Cruz in 2026 for this, like, ballot measure to get the success that, like, Santa Cruz has been wanting for so long. And, like, those, like, one ballot, you know, one measure, like, voting, it seems like a lot, and it seems like it's expensive for no reason and they're just wasting money. But when it's, like, consistently the city of Santa Cruz wants something and they just don't get it, those elections are important. And I think that's why we don't see, like, people coming out to the primaries, because there's not enough elections like that where we see our vote actually have effect.
Yeah. It's like, how do we change? How do we, like, have more people really understand that, I guess, is the question, because it's just, it's so hard to get people to actually care.
Yeah, it's definitely expensive, but if you, like, Santa Cruz is going to show their constituents that, hey, you guys have been wanting this for a long time, you've said that you wanted this for a long time, so now vote on it. Go and vote at the ballot box in this one special election and get what you want.
I think kind of on that topic, the issue with getting more people involved in, like, different political movements, a lot of it is just unmotivation. I feel a lot of people have lost hope, and I feel like that's a really important thing. My dad is a poli sci major, so I've had a lot of interesting conversations with him. And, I mean, we'll talk and we'll chat, and we'll be like, oh, well, we want to see these changes in X, Y, and Z. And for him, it kind of ends up as this thing like, oh, well, like, in reality, like, that's not going to happen kind of thing. And it's like, well, who's to say that, you know what I mean? Like, I feel like at the end of the day, like, we have to hold on to hope. And I, especially as, like, the, you know, next generation coming up, like, if we don't have hope, we don't have anything, you know? This current political climate, like, things just seem to be going down a road where we feel like we, you know, there's no turning back from. And, like, I don't know, maybe that is the case, but should we just accept that? I feel like that's a really big thing, and it's just so important to try to keep staying politically motivated, even though it seems impossible, especially now, because, I mean, like, the people running the show aren't going to be alive for much longer. They're not going to have to worry about, you know, what we're left with, so.
Yeah, let's do some climate crisis. Okay. As climate concerns increase, is it an individual's responsibility to address independent consumption? Is it productive to cast blame on the individual or rather the larger institutions? How does the individual cope with the effects of climate change? Are there ways for individuals to get involved on a local level? So kind of something we've been talking about. Go for it.
The entire idea of an individual's carbon footprint was literally, I think, created by Shell Oil or British Petroleum or something. Like, yes, there is a small percentage of you know, U.S. pollution is the individual consumer. Like again, your small things do have impact. You buying a hybrid car will be slightly better for the environment. But I do not think that the main burden is on the independent consumer. It is, yes.
Yeah. I will say just. I mean, climate change is like pollution. Air pollution in general is one of the first examples of externalities you learn about in economics, where you have one company making something, another person buying it, and then everyone else paying the price for it. And The thing is that those sorts of things are the kind of things that third party action, usually by states, is pretty much the only sustainable way to solve it, because otherwise there's too much incentive for individuals to just take higher polluting items that have higher prices. It also doesn't help that in most cases you have no idea what your carbon footprint is for a given product, how much your meat is, how much the peanut butter you buy at the grocery store is. I mean, developed countries have some of the highest per capita CO2 emissions, especially when adjusted for how much product creation is offshored. Because people want all of these things, and they're not always willing to care about the climate as a whole to get them. And it's up to governments to invest in public transit to get people to stop going in cars that emit 20 times as much per person as a bus, or subsidize the green energy. It might not be as necessary now that it's cheaper. So that we can get to that energy transition faster and get people to have both higher quality of life and not have the air be polluted and clogged with CO2 that is destroying our environment. Collective action is the only real way to do it, and blaming individual consumers when only a minority, frankly, is going to care about it is not a viable solution. I'm sorry.
I would like to build off that viable solution bit you made at the end, because I feel like climate change is very different from other political issues in the sense that it is overwhelmingly non-debatable, right? There's no, you can't look at the scientific research that's been backed up for, decades at this point and say, no, right? It doesn't matter if you say no, because in 50 years when you have a hurricane in California, it didn't matter what you said, how you voted, whatever. This is going to be the consequences of all of our actions in the end. And it's something that is not just a matter of opinion, it's a matter of impending catastrophe. So I feel like it's a very different contextualization when you talk about climate change as a political issue, in such a way that what we were talking about earlier, and this idea of organizing on a local level, and maybe it's not going to work, and frequently it doesn't work, but you got to try. That's a very admirable idea, but I feel like it doesn't apply in this situation, because climate change, it's if we want a future, our future has been sold already. Right. And if we want it back, we have to take it in this way that's it's not acceptable to say, well, I mean, maybe we'll give it our best shot. Right. We need this. And blaming the individual consumer is such a herding cats kind of solution. There's just realistically this no practical way where we're going to say, OK, we're going to get so many people in this hyper individualistic culture of America and other first world countries to drastically change their lifestyle in such a manner that we're actually going to offset the majority of pollution caused by large corporations. That's just not feasible. And I feel like this is one of those things where the only solution is you have to really attack it an issue that we need to solve. And the only way we're going to solve it is by going after the corporations who are causing the majority of the emissions to begin with. Right. So.
Yeah. And I feel like a part of that is a lot of corporations try to twist it, which is it's so interesting to me to see different companies come out with different statements about what they're going to do to combat climate change, which can be important, but I find it interesting because we're being almost sold sustainability, and we're expected, with the blame is placed on us, and we're expected to be the ones to make that change and come up with that solution, when it's kind of well, you're the one who's the problem in the first place. And I feel like something important to note too is that unfortunately, a lot of times, products that you're buying and stuff aren't sustainable. But I feel like a lot of it goes back into socioeconomics, what state are you in? You know what I mean? If you are a single parent, with a lot of children, or just not in a financial state where you can make the decision to buy something that is more sustainable, because it's more expensive. I feel like that's something that's important to take into account for too, because again, we're being sold sustainability, which, is even more expensive. And then it's here are these people who, are working paycheck to paycheck, and it's they can't, you're going to place the blame on them kind of thing. I don't know.
I mean, and I became political because of climate change. I was very concerned in high school. And I think that, and I really had that feeling too, where I was this is an issue that it's different from all the other ones, because it's this is the one guy. I was tweaking 24/7, right? Rightly so, you know, like, look, every day going around and being like, why isn't everyone like freaking out all the time? Like, what, like, what's happening? It's crazy, right? Like, it's, I mean, and it's devastating because, like, let's be real, like there's no going back. Like, we've already, climate change is already happening right now. There's no going back. Like, it's not, it's far too late to prevent. You know, it's questions of mitigation at this point, right? And that's really hard, you know, like, to it's a hard pill to swallow, I think, because there was a time when we actually could have prevented, like, climate breakdown from happening, and it's over now, and, like, it's really sad, and I think that, I guess, a quote that I like by Naomi Klein is, she says, what scares me most is not climate change, but is what scarcity looks like in an economic system as brutal as ours, and, like, that's not a very happy quote, but I guess to me, it's already happening. Climate crisis is already totally happening, and so it's a question of, like, you know, who gets hurt the most and how do we, you know what I mean? Like, the ultra wealthy are going to hold out for as long as they can, right? So that's, I think, what it becomes. It, like, you know, it always goes back to kind of being this class issue. But I agree at the same time, like, if there was, like, an eco-capitalist way to, like, that could have prevented the breakdown, I would have been all in. Like, let's go. Like, I would have been like, I don't even care. Like, I'll sell out my other ethics because, like, this is something that you just can't reverse, you know? And it's literally apocalyptic, right? But I don't know. I guess all that to say, like, I think that's why for me, like, I've accepted the possibility that it might turn out really, really bad, and things are very, very bleak. But at the same time, that there is so much to do and so much to save, like, so many lives to save and to better. Like, you know what I mean? I think that it's not, like, over until, like, everyone's dead, you know? So in that way, the struggle goes on. But I do think that we have to recontextualize a little bit. We're never gonna get, you know, the dream that we thought, or at least that I thought, you know, the world was going to be when I was a small child. And I was like, things are going to be good, you know, like, that's gone. Like, that is just dead, you know, unfortunately. But there, you know, we can be born again, you know, from the ashes of disaster, you know. So I don't know. I don't want to be like a doomer, but because it's like, I'm not. But like, at the same time, I don't like the, you know, you got to be real about, like, what's going on with the climate change specifically, because I think a lot of leftists, they just don't want to talk about it. They're just like, I don't want to talk about it. Like, it's already, it's literally happening right now. Like, it's happening all the time. Like, it's so warm right now. Way too warm. Super weird.
I actually want to jump on that point about people not wanting to talk about it, because I think this ties back into our concept of, like, political apathy. Is one is that there's a lot of factors that go into it, right? Like, the fact that people feel like it doesn't matter, the fact that it feels like they don't change anything, but also the fact that, especially for our generation, very uniquely, because of how, you know, our world has progressed technologically, how we control more and more of the planet as a dominant species, whatever, the stakes always just get higher and higher. And I feel like climate change is, like, the ultimate example of that. And what we're talking about literally right now is the apocalypse. And I think that's just something that's just simply not swallowable for a lot of people. I think that that's why it's one of the hardest issues to get some traction on, despite it being seemingly the most obvious, clear, important issue, is that people don't like to acknowledge that. I mean, I don't want to be the one, but we're done for, right? And it's something that when you impress upon people how serious the situation is, they just pull further and further away from it, because it's like, we do live, like, a lot of our talk so far has been this very kind of hypothetical almost, because we are living in a first world nation that allows us to be at least a little bit removed, right? It is a privilege to talk about politics the way we're talking about it, but climate change is one of those things that challenges that. It's like, you don't get to remove yourself from this conversation. And because you don't get to do that, people just don't participate to begin with, right? And I mean, I don't really, I guess there's no point in this observation, because I don't think it's a wise thing to say, so let's not talk about it in such an apocalyptic way, because it does need to be discussed in reality. But I mean, I like to have a little snappy kind of conclusion, but it's really just sad, man. Like,
you know what I'm going to bring this back to? I'm going to bring this back to building community. Because in the effects of disaster mitigation, in friends in my hometown, we've actively witnessed this. Because I'm from the Pasadena area, which was directly, I'm high-fiving Ryan from across the room. Because I've had friends whose houses literally burnt down in the Eaton fires. But you know what? You know what happened? You know what happened? The community, a community that, you know, sometimes was more individualist, would come together to help each other in disaster. And if disaster, it's call this a weird hope, but if disaster becomes more prevalent, maybe community will. And you know how we do that? We make the community come together. We are the community. Woo!
Woo! I like that. I like that positive anecdote. Okay. Well, you were on KZSC Santa Cruz 88.1.
I presume this was not live, right?
Yeah.
Was
I don't think so. I think it was
Thank you. This wasn't live, right?
No.
Okay. I was like,